I know, it's ugly out there, but if you think you're nervous, imagine, if you can, what Janet Yellen is thinking right now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Wednesday, I do believe, is the 20th of January. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Among the things we know on this latest in a series of dreary days in the global economy is this. And we know it, I should say, as surely as we know anything at all. Janet Yellen is looking around right now going, wait, what? Yes, I know the ground rules for our hit game show, What is Janet Yellen Thinking? Call for five words, but hey, my game rhyme rules, right? I want you to forget about stocks, though, for a minute here. Yes, they are the bright, shiny object, but equities aren't always a good guide to what is actually going on out there. You want that? Go to bonds. And the bond market of late has been telling a more discouraging story even than stocks. The yield on the benchmark 10-year Treasury note today closed at 1.99%. That is to say, the interest rate that it pays went down, exactly the opposite of what Janet Yellen and the Fed want to be happening. So Marketplace's Bree Benishore gets us going with what's going on in bonds.
The thing about bonds is, the more popular they are, the less you get out of them.
The more people that buy bonds, what they do is they drive the price of the bond higher.
Jim Paulson is chief investment strategist with Wells Capital Management. The more expensive a bond gets, the more it eats into the value of the bond, the less the payoff.
That's what drives the yield lower.
It's actually as if you were buying like a $10 coupon at the grocery store. If you had to pay $9 for a $10 coupon, what are you getting out of that coupon? You're getting like a dollar in savings. If you had to pay $9.50 for a $10 coupon, you're getting, you know, just 50 cents. This is what has been happening to 10-year Treasury bonds in 2016.
So the drop in 10-year yields that we've experienced this year is all about more and more people buying bonds, driving their prices up and their yields lower.
So the question is, why is everyone buying these 10-year bonds, and why are they okay with shrinking yields?
Fear on Wall Street is on the rise.
Michael Farr is CEO of Farr Miller in Washington.
When fear increases, people head to safety.
Treasuries are backed by the U.S. government. They are the world's safest investment. So what's turned the wolf of Wall Street into a skittish puppy?
Well, how many reasons do you want? So there's a confluence of factors here.
Jay Morlock is an economist with FTN Financial. For starters, there's the overall dismal performance of the U.S. stock market. Some brokerages have told investors to sell off stocks and cling to something safer, like bonds. But there's plenty of fear abroad.
Emerging markets are fragile.
Let's just start with China. China's currency is weakening. And if you're someone in China who has debt in dollars and your own currency is losing value,
it makes it much harder to pay that debt. So what we've seen is a big rush to the exits in the yuan.
And a good place to park money is in U.S. Treasury bonds. And remember, a 10-year T-note is something you can hang on to for 10 years, which means investors are looking out 10 years, and they're still afraid. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
At the close on the New York Mercantile Exchange today, you could buy a barrel of West Texas Intermediate crude oil for $26.55. That is almost 7% less than that same barrel cost just yesterday. The crash in crude has been disastrous for oil and gas producers, the ones who will go out drilling for the stuff. Also, presumably bad for the banks that lend them the money to do it, right? Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story from the Sustainability Desk.
The last oil bust of 1986 sparked a Texas banking rout, says longtime bank analyst Charles Peabody of Portales Partners.
Basically, all the major Texas banks either failed or were bought out by a larger East Coast bank.
But since then, energy finance has changed dramatically, and fewer alarm bells are going off, even though oil sells for a quarter of its recent peak. Oil lending has spread out among banks, among hedge funds, private equity, and for all the exuberance of the fracking boom, the banks stayed disciplined, says analyst Mike Mayo at investment firm CLSA.
There was a silver lining from the financial crisis, and that is that the banking industry doubled down on ensuring that they lent to the best borrowers. This is not The Big Short Part 2.
That is for the banks. For the drillers, their endless well of money is drying up. Now they may pay $50 to pump a barrel of oil that sells for just $27. Their credit lines got cut some 40% last fall. And many drillers bought guaranteed high selling prices, called hedges, that will expire soon. Buddy Hayes is with the energy practice of the law firm Haynes Boone.
With less hedge, think of it as price insurance, the companies will be more exposed to a potential borrowing base reductions, and you would expect less of that protection going into 2016.
The question will be, what happens when an oil or gas company can't pay its debt? That's a tough call for the bank. It can push liquidation or bankruptcy and take a loss, or it can keep lending and cross its fingers, says Charles Peabody.
The old adage used to be a rolling loan gathers no loss. Keep rolling those loans when they came due in an effort to keep their client afloat. But history shows the losses actually grew over time.
He says drillers and their bankers are in for a two-and-a-half-year period of pain that could go well into 2017. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
All right, so about the markets, I gave you the 10-year T-note already, so that part of the numbers is shot, I guess. As to the rest of the day on Wall Street, boy, a no-good, terrible, very bad day that actually ended better than you might have thought. Still, though, it's going to be the wah-wah trombones when we get there, I think. If I get to decide, it would be, but I don't. We know that. Details, numbers, you know the drill. President Obama was in Detroit today. He took a swing by the Shinola store in town, did some shopping, I guess. Speaking of which, Shinola, that is, we'll have the CEO of that company on the program tomorrow. But back to the president, no word on what he might have bought at Shinola. He also, though, hit the North American International Auto Show while he was in town, one of 800,000 people expected to show up over the 2 weeks that that show runs. Not too many of those people, though, are likely to venture beyond the four walls of the exhibition center, so the city is trying to get its visitors out a little bit. WDET's Laura Herberg reports.
Soumya Dev is smoking a cigarette outside Kobo Center, where the auto show takes place. He works on social media for Ford in Bangkok. This is his first time in Detroit.
So far, I haven't seen much of the city. So far, it's been from the hotel to the Kobo Center every day and back to the hotel.
For most of the professionals visiting Detroit, the trip isn't a vacation, it's work. But this Thailand resident says he'll finally get a little time to explore Detroit after he spends the afternoon checking out auto show exhibits.
And later on, I want to go downtown and definitely go to Slow's.
Slow's is a nearby barbecue joint that's been featured in the international press. But locals know it's not the only restaurant in town. And that's why more than a dozen people have been hired to be Detroit ambassadors at the auto show.
Because people will say, well, what do you suggest? And I say, well, what are you interested in? Because there's so much to choose from.
Jennifer Rood is one of the ambassadors here.
So we're basically helping individuals find their way around Kobo, and if they're interested in going to any place outside of Kobo for dinner or entertainment or anything, we're kind of helping guide them in that way.
Rood estimates she answers around 100 questions a day, including everything from where's a good place to get a drink to can I take an Uber to Canada, which is just on the other side of the Detroit River. If attendees have a question about the cars inside Kobo Center, she can connect them to industry experts using an iPad. Rood and the other ambassadors are being supplied by the Detroit Experience Factory, a local organization that runs a welcome center and employs knowledgeable Detroiters to take people on excursions. There are a couple tours planned during the show, but here at Kobo Center, their staffers are basically just standing around answering questions. So, what's the big deal? Jeanette Pierce is the Detroit Experience Factory's executive director. She says what they're doing inside Kobo matters because it is a first step to meaningful engagement.
Some people want to have a deeper conversation, right? They might start with, where can I go for this? And then you start talking with them. Then they leave with a better understanding of what's happening in Detroit.
Michelle Ortali is perusing souvenirs at the Detroit shop inside the convention center. She works with a company in Brazil called Mixum. She's paused at a display of T-shirts.
I'm shopping a T-shirt for my uncle because he loves cars, Detroit.
So do you know what shirt you're going to get him?
I think this one.
Ortali lays her hand on a navy blue tee with a logo that's made to look old. In white and red cracked lettering, the shirt reads, Motor City Detroit, established 1701. For Ortali, who hasn't had time to explore the city, this generic message might be the only thing she'll take home about Detroit. The hope is that as the ambassador program continues, more industry professionals will be able to bring home their own personal report from an actual experience with the city. That is, of course, assuming they have the time. In Detroit, I'm Laura Herberg for Marketplace.
There's news today about television, specifically the audience ratings thereof that come to us by way of Nielsen. Mostly Nielsen measures people watching shows, either live, in real time, or played back on a DVR. But the company has also started measuring people talking about television shows on social media. It's been tracking Twitter for a while, people tweeting and retweeting, I don't know, Game of Thrones or Monday Night Football or what have you. Now, though, Nielsen is going to add all the talk about TV shows flying around on Facebook. It's part of what's being called social content ratings, designed to give media companies and, more importantly, advertisers a better read on who is tuned into what. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on that one.
So let's take the popular CBS show, The Big Bang Theory. It's number two in primetime, according to Nielsen.
I'd like to have Yoda come to me in my dreams.
Really?
Well, yeah,
now, this isn't the show itself. It's a short promo video on YouTube of the actors saying which Star Wars character their character would want to be. Perfect clickbait for fans to share with their friends on Facebook. And Nielsen hasn't had a good pulse on social media like this about shows, says S&P analyst Tuna Amobi.
The perception for a long time in the industry is that Nielsen has been somewhat, you know, slow to adapt their measurement to the changing patterns of media consumption.
Amobi says Nielsen will now have more big data for media companies about the reach and demographics of all those posts and likes and shares, which isn't the same as knowing how many people actually see a show and its ads, says Philip Swan of TVPredictions.com.
I think all it does is measure noise and buzz. You might simply say, you know, I tend to think the star of that show also doesn't look good these days. Doesn't mean you're watching the show.
But analyst Jack Myers says in an age of people watching TV where and whenever they want, measuring social media tells advertisers something valuable.
Audience engagement, which programs are getting the original buzz, which programs are getting shares and likes.
Nielsen says that data about shares and likes, by the way, won't identify individual Facebook users. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, I suppose in the same way that Homeland was able to dovetail with hard news, contemporary news, this has the ability to do the same thing, or not.
Hedge funds, U.S. attorneys, and actor Damian Lewis. Straight ahead, but first, yeah, why not? Let's do the numbers. I feel so much better now. The Dow Industrials, uncertainty kills you, right? The Dow Industrials lost 249 points today, 1.5%, closed at 15,766. The NASDAQ declined 5 points, 1/10%, finished at 4,471. The S&P 500 down 21 points, 1.1%, 18.59. Could have been worse, which is to say it was worse. At one point in the day, the major indices off 3% or more, 566 points on the Dow. Ouch. One big drag on the market continues to be big oil, or rather the continued drop in big oil prices. Chevron slipped more than 3% today. CONSOL Energy slipped 1.5%. Scott Tong was telling us earlier the effects of declining oil prices go well beyond the energy sector. Banks have a lot of loans to oil producers on their balance sheets. Wells Fargo sliced off 0.7%. Bank of America down nearly 4% today. IBM had the blues today. Get it? IBM? Blues. The company said revenue fell for the 15th straight quarter. I don't even know what that is in years. IBM disconnected 4.8%. And you, you're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Getting more low-income students into college has been one of the big goals of the Obama administration's education department. Getting them in, though, is of course only half of the equation. The other half is getting those students graduated once they have enrolled. To that end, the administration's floating a plan to expand the Pell Grant program to give low-income students a better shot at completing their education and actually getting that degree. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
Only about 60% of students who enroll in bachelor's degree programs graduate within 6 years. And even among those who do, many say getting a diploma took longer and cost more than they expected.
Staying in school longer is very expensive. You pay more tuition and you take more time out of the labor force.
Sandy Baum is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute.
Also, the longer it goes on, the less likely you are to finish.
Life gets in the way, she says, especially for low-income students who may be trying to balance a job, family responsibilities, and their education. And students who drop out of college are 3 times more likely to default on student debt. The new Pell Grant proposals are aimed at getting students through school faster. Students who take 15 credits a semester, a full load, would get an extra $300. Students who add a third semester, say during the summer, could be eligible to receive an additional $1,900 a year if they're going full time. Pauline Abernathy is with the Institute for College Access and Success.
For those who can afford to go full-time during the school year, this will certainly help them complete faster.
The year-round funding, if it passes, would benefit about 700,000 students. Currently, there are more than 8 million students that receive Pell Grants.
Clearly, by having the full-time requirement, it does also reduce the cost of the program significantly.
We've tried a version of year-round Pell Grants before, but they were eliminated as part of federal budget cuts back in 2011. Experts think there's a chance that these changes, with a price tag of $2 billion, may have enough congressional support this budget cycle to stand a chance. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Damian Lewis is probably best known for his role as Nicholas Brody in Showtime's long-running series Homeland, or maybe, if you go back a bit, Dick Winters in Band of Brothers. Lewis has a new show now. It's called Billions, also on Showtime, playing billionaire hedge fund investor Bobby Axelrod.
When did it become a crime to succeed in this country? America used to salute the guy in the limousine. They wanted to be the guy in the limousine. They still want to, but now they throw eggs at it.
I was in New York a couple of months ago on the set of Billions up in the Bronx. It was cold, a little bit drizzly. And between takes, Damian Lewis sat down to talk about his new role, his career, and the business that he is in.
Damian Lewis, thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure.
You did some research for this role?
Yes.
You went out and talked to hedge fund guys?
Yes, I did.
When you said to them, how do you do what you do and what's your thought process, what did they say?
The consensus was that they're a risk-averse, analytical, scientific bunch. They're very smart, and I think there's an element of feeling that they're the underdogs. They are taking risks that others aren't prepared to take.
They feel they're the underdogs.
Yeah, I think they are, and in many ways they are, because they're betting against the market often, and they're in a minority. But I think what was interesting mostly was that even though it's a nice metaphor to think of Wall Street as just a big casino where the odds are set by the house and the house is Wall Street. These guys are really risk averse. They don't like risk. They don't want to run risk. So their research and their analysts are working. They maintain harder and in greater detail than any other analysts.
There are people who are going to listen to this program and they're going to hear you speaking this way and they're going to say, wait a minute, Damian Lewis is a Brit.
That's correct. But you've come to me on set, and I speak in an American accent from the moment I get in the van in the morning.
Do you?
I do.
Easier for you?
Easier, I think. I'm not good enough just to flip in and out of
my Brit accent
to my American accent, you know. Yeah, it's hard. Actually, we have an English DOP. You know, occasionally you have English members of crew.
And yeah.
I don't avoid them, but there's always a moment I have to recalibrate after I've, you know, spent 5 minutes talking to them.
How did you come to the show, by the way?
I was called up, and I had no intention of doing another TV show immediately after Homeland anyway, which I figured might be a way to sort of go out on top because it was such fun and so well-regarded and smart. And then this script came along, and I felt the same things about it, that it could be that too, smart and a big hit and enjoyed by people and watched by a big sort of broad range of people and enjoyed for different reasons in the way that Homeland was. And also, you know, I suppose in the same way that Homeland was able to dovetail with hard news, right, contemporary news, right, this has the ability to do the same thing, borrow from the headlines and or not, you know, but the parallels are there, and those parallels are there to be drawn, and they're fun to draw, you know, as the season goes on.
Do you know when you read a script that you want to do something?
No, my decision-making process is tortured and dithering and uncertain at all times. I think long and hard about what I do. I say no much, much more than I say yes. I'm very cautious. Actually, I'm a bit of a cautious Cuthbert that way when it comes to choosing work. I can't live with myself if I'm doing something that I don't fully believe in.
You got a shelf full of Emmys and Golden Globes and all that stuff. Do you now call yourself a success?
It's a small shelf. It's a narrow shelf.
But it's full. It
goes in a recess by my fireplace.
Have you made it?
I don't think people ever think they make it. I'm extremely lucky, and I enjoy the level of work that I'm able to work at. And, you know, it's that I'm not 21. It's just, you know, who's that guy? He just exploded. You know, it's kind of a critical mass of, you know, of hopefully good work over a period of time. You know, and, you know, maybe that's what I mean by being cautious about choosing work. I've been careful to work with, you know, good people on interesting material, I hope, mostly. And so, no, I don't think I've made it. There's always, you know, I don't have an Oscar. I mean, you know.
Do feature films, are they attractive to you?
Feature films are very attractive to me. Something happened to me 10, 12 years ago where I got offered a project called Band of Brothers.
Yeah.
It turned out to be one of the sort of great hits of, frankly, the last 10 or 15 years, you know, and it's still watched and adored by people. And as a result of that, I found that the quality of TV material that came to me was so great and was just often better than the film material I got. And when I find a good movie that I really like, I jump on it because it's exciting to do. Whether it's a director that I'm interested in working with or the cast that's assembled is particularly exciting. But mostly, I just find the witty and ambitious and political, smart material comes to me through TV more than it has in film. And because I've never been a snob about film and TV, I've tended to do the TV stuff. And actually, coincidentally, it's been just a happy, happy accident that TV has morphed into this creature that it has become in the last 10 or 15 years at pretty much exactly the same time that I came of age as an actor. And so all this great material was available to me. And then it was just luck. I had an American accent tucked away up my sleeve and I was able to win these roles. So it's just been a happy sort of coincidence, the whole thing.
Damian Lewis, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Billions airs Sunday nights on Showtime. You can hear the interview with the creators of that show. It's on our website, marketplace.org.
This final note on the way out today, two real quick ones, actually. First of all, I know we talk a lot about CEOs on this program. We've got a whole segment about them, for that matter, Conversations from the Corner Office. Perhaps you've heard of it. Our friends at Quartz picked up on an item today along those lines, and not in a good way, I should say. A survey by Edelman, the big public relations firm, showed that 53% of Americans can't name a single corporate chief executive. That might be seen, I grant you, as Edelman looking to drum up PR business among company chief executives, but so be it. Also, just for the record, since we've been using them a lot lately, I've been told by a listener or two or three that what I claim are the wah-wah trombones are actually not trombones. Flugelhorns have been suggested. I, however, am still going with trombones because wah-wah flugelhorns? Seriously? No. Write to me. Tell me I'm wrong. They totally sound like trombones. All right, we're out of here. The Dow off 249 points today, 1.5%. That was not, believe it or not, the session low. The NASDAQ off 5 points, about a 10%. The S&P 500 down 21 points, 1.1% there. Chris Clark, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.